From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present another episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank talked with Middle East and Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim. Let's now join Hank as he introduces his guest.
Well, welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged. My guest today is going to be Raymond Ibrahim. And Raymond is a unique individual. He's got an encyclopedic knowledge of Islam. He's a Coptic Christian born and raised in America. He speaks fluent Arabic, and he's a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's an Associate Fellow at the Middle East Forum. He's been all over the news, particularly of late. He has his own website, RaymondIbrahim.com, and we're going to have a fascinating discussion. But I want to start it out by reading a quote from Malcolm Muggeridge. It sort of sets the tone in terms of what's happening in the West. This quote from Malcolm Muggeridge, of course, he was a 20th century British journalist. He was a satirist. He was a broadcaster. He became a devout follower of Jesus Christ in his 60s, and as such, a fierce defender of the faith. But he said something I think is worth starting this podcast out with. He said that whereas other civilizations have been brought down by attacks of barbarians from without, our civilization has that unique distinction of training its own destroyers at its own educational institutions and then providing them with facilities for propagating their destructive ideologies, all at public expense. Thus said Muggeridge, did Western man decide to abolish himself, creating his own boredom out of his own affluence, his own vulnerability out of his own strength, his own impotence out of his own erotomania, himself blowing the trumpet that brought the walls of his own city tumbling down, and having convinced himself that he was too numerous, labored with pill and scalpel and syringe to make himself fewer, until at last, having educated himself into imbecility and polluted and drugged himself into stupefaction, he keeled over a weary, battered old brontosaurus and became extinct. And I bring this up because we ought to note that filling the vacuum that has been left by dying aborted Westerners are polygamous Muslims who have little or no intent on assimilation into Western culture. And while this is going on in the West, mass genocide is taking place in the East. And I don't know of anyone who has written about this more eloquently than my guest, Raymond Ibrahim. His book, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians, is an absolute must in terms of reading. But here's someone who is fluent in Arabic, someone who knows what's going on in the Middle East. And I am just delighted, Raymond, to have you on this podcast as we sort of talk about things that people aren't talking about and should be talking about.
Hi, Hank. I'm very happy to be with you, and thank you for that excellent introduction, as well as that quote you just read, because actually it pertains so much to so much that's going on in the world, but especially to this question of Islam and its interaction with the West and other civilizations and Christians and so forth. You know, that Western civilization is so unique in that it is the only one that so actively works to undermine itself. This is precisely what happens with the question of Islam. You know, right now I'm working my newest book, which is titled Sword and Scimitar, and it'll be coming out sometime in 2018, is a military history of Islam and the West, which, of course, you know, the West is a new name. Most civilizations aren't named after a geographical location. So the West, of course, used to be Christendom up until very recently. So that's what the history is about. But the point is, when you look at it, I've always known this, and this is why I wanted to write the book. But the more research I've done, the more even I have been surprised to find out just how parallel what groups like ISIS or the Islamic State are doing, how parallel and how much they mirror what Islamic sultans and caliphs and, whirling dervishes even have done for almost 14 centuries against Europe and Christian civilization. It's identical. It's actually much worse. And so the point here is, yet here we are saying ISIS has nothing to do with Islam. Islam means peace and so forth. And, you know, we can get into the theological argument, and I think a lot of people have done that, including myself, whereby we show how, you know, so-called Islamic radicals are actually justified by the words of the Quran, by the words of Muhammad, and so forth. But it's actually more mind-boggling to me to witness the history, which is just identical, unwavering, one long 14th-century ISIS attack on Europe, constant. And so the reason I say this again is if you go into a history class today, whether it's in college, whether it's, of course, in public schools and so forth, all of it has been whitewashed. You're going to get one sentence about how Islam basically expanded, and then you're going to get a lot of hoopla about how it's one of the Abrahamic faiths, and basically it's so close to Judaism and Christianity, and really there is no real disagreement, and if there ever has been conflict, it's been a misunderstanding and so forth. And people believe this, and this is why they can sit back, as you read in that quote. They've been indoctrinated by themselves and by their own institutions and by their own intellectuals into believing the exact reverse of what happened historically. And that's why we can sit here today and we're mind-boggled about this phenomena of ISIS, and we're all trying to distance it from Islam, and it doesn't make sense, and why did it happen now? When in reality, it is just a continuation of a 14th-century jihad, unwavering jihad on the West and on other civilizations. But we don't know that because we have actively undermined ourselves from the educational institutions, from Hollywood, of course, and movies, or from the churches and preachers who talk about Islam and true history. And so here we are, completely paralyzed by ourselves.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you talk about what's going on in terms of history. We should go back to the beginnings and talk about Muhammad versus Christ, because one of the things I picked up in what you just said is that many people, as you correctly note, are thinking that Islam is one of the three great Abrahamic religions and do not understand that this is a cult of both Judaism and Christianity. It's an aberration of both. When I was at the University of Tehran in Iran and Alma Tabetaba, the sociology university, this is one of the things I heard over and over again. We are one of the great Abrahamic faiths. And they were communicating this in a collegial fashion to me. But the reality is, this is an aberration of both Judaism and Christianity. Expand on that a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, the main point of what you're saying, people will always tell us what you're saying right now, which is, oh, this is one of the Abrahamic faiths. The problem with that line of reasoning is it's formulated by secular minds that just do not comprehend what it means to have faith and religion. Okay, so Judaism comes along, and you know, we have the Torah, the Pentateuch, basically what we call the Old Testament. Christians accept it as it is. They've taken it. It is the same, you know, Bible, the Old Testament, that Jews traditionally have used. So we don't say Abraham did something different than what Jews said, and we don't say Moses did something differently. And then, of course, there's a New Testament, which, and there's a disagreement, of course, between Judaism and Christianity. But what Islam did, as you said, is not just mix and match and create its own narrative. But to give you an analogy, if I have, let's say, a revered family that I love, and my ancestors that I know, and I know their stories, I know their names, I know what they did, and they're mine. Now, other people who are not related to me, well, okay, so that's what he says, that's his family, good for him, we have nothing to do with it. But what Muslims basically did, it's like they came along and said, yeah, we love that family that you have. And that's the point that, you know, secularists make. Like, you see, you guys are similar. But then they don't just love the family that we have, and they don't just build on it. They've changed their names. They've changed what this family has said, what this family has done. And so I ask you, if that's, I have a family and I have an ancestry that I'm proud of, who am I actually going to be more understanding with? A group like, let's say, to keep the analogy going, Hindus or Buddhists, who have nothing to do with this ancestry and don't say anything against or for it, or a group that comes and basically appropriates it, changes their names, changes what they did, changes what they stand for. The Islamic Jesus, Isa, is going to come back and break all the crosses, kill all the pigs, and attack Christians because they made him the son of God, for example. So you can see that when one group, what Muslims have done is not by highlighting the same characters from the Old and New Testament, that doesn't make them closer. If anything, that creates contention between them and both Jews and Christians, because they've taken their holy people and they've changed them around and they've said this is who and what they are. So actually, we are in, because of that, we are in big arguments and contradiction. But the secular mind presents it all as just kind of, you know, throws it all in one bowl. Oh, look, they also believe in Abraham and Jesus, and so let's all sing, you know, hold hands and be happy. And they miss the more subtle aspect of actually creating a very large rift by appropriating such prophets and peoples.
Yeah, and then you have, I think this probably is part of the discussion as well. I mean, you talk to so many people that don't know a whole lot about Christianity today, or a lot of people that certainly don't know a whole lot about Islam, but in their minds, there's sort of an equation or a parallel between the two. And I think it's helpful probably for those listening into our conversation to underscore the difference between Muhammad and Christ. I mean, in some ways, we talk about two different Muhammads. There was a Meccan Muhammad, just as there was a Medinan Muhammad. But you look at the Medinan Muhammad, and he is a ruthless warlord. You look at Christ, and he's one that said, put away the sword, he who lives by the sword is going to die by the sword. The distinction or the chasm or the distance between Christ and Muhammad seems to be one of infinity, and yet they're talked about like they're sort of parallel leaders and have a lot in common.
Exactly, and that's part of the ongoing effort to make everything relative, basically to neutralize and, you know, take Christianity down and raise Islam up. And, you know, you just say they're the same. But as you noted, the character of Christ and the character of Muhammad are essentially antithetical to one another. They are the difference between night and day, black and white, right and wrong. And I don't say this as a Christian. I say this very objectively, that if you have any sorts of ethics or a set of moral standards, and you look at the things that Jesus said, and you compare and contrast it with the things that Muhammad did, this is just black and white difference. There's nothing whatsoever close about them. One tells you to forgive your enemy and to pray for those who persecute you, and one says kill and maim and rape and enslave anyone who doesn't accept your God. That's a vast difference. As for the Mecca-Medina dichotomy, yes, you're correct. The Mecca verses or surahs of the Quran, or basically, to those who are unfamiliar, the Quran was believed by Muslims to have been revealed, quote-unquote, in two phases. The first phase, the older phase, the original phase, is when Muhammad was living in Mecca. He was essentially outnumbered and weak. He had less than a handful of followers who believed him. And he's very much in this period like an Old Testament prophet who's just basically preaching fire and brimstone and threatening people to believe in the one God and to et cetera, et cetera. And largely the Meccan verses that appear at this period are the ones that the apologists for Islam will pick and choose from to show you the tolerance aspects of Islam. So within those verses, you have things such as you have your religion and I have mine, implying that, you know, each one can believe their own way. And then Muhammad went to Medina. He became a political leader and he grew in strength significantly, and then on the war path, which essentially consisted of caravan raids for booty and plunder, and the Quran's pretty clear about that. Now, in this context, we got what's called the Medinan revelations. Now, these are remarkably different than the Meccan ones. Now, it's basically a manual for how to raid and plunder, and but surrounded in the garb of religious language. It's being done for God and God's sake, or Allah, and so forth. And this is where you have verses like Quran 9 and 9:29. Which says, fight the people of the book, which is Islam's name for Christians and Jews specifically, until they pay jizya, that's the word used, which means tribute in exchange for their lives, so they buy their lives, and feel themselves humbled and subdued.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim. With 1,600,000,000 strong and growing, Islam is poised to fill the vacuum left by a Western culture slouching inexorably toward Gomorrah. Demographics alone are alarming. While polygamist Muslims boast a robust birth rate, native Westerners are moving rapidly toward self-extinction. Filling the void are multiplied millions of Muslims who have no intention of assimilating into Western culture. But there is one real solution to a disintegrating West and resurgent Islam. It is the power of the gospel through Jesus Christ. Read Hank Hanegraaff's new book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. To receive your copy as our thanks for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. We'll be back in just a moment with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Are you the product of millions of years of unguided, purposeless natural processes? Or are you created in the image of a loving God? Faced with the overwhelming scorn of evolutionary proselytizers, it can be hard to articulate the truth about God's creative work. And even among faithful Christians, many misconceptions linger. The Creation Answer book by Hank Hanegraaff puts answers to the most hotly debated origins questions right at your fingertips, giving you clarity and understanding. Learn to articulate the truth about our origins clearly and compassionately when you request your copy of the Creation Answer book, or listen to Hank's insightful answers with the unabridged audiobook version on CD. Receive your copy of the Creation Answer Book or the audiobook on CD from the Christian Research Institute when you call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. The Coen brothers are among the most critically acclaimed film directors of our time. Yet the meaning behind their movies is often veiled in mystery. This offers a clue about the Coens' worldview. The difficulty is part of the design. Other topics include changing attitudes toward the resurrection of Jesus. Is a pro-life hermeneutic possible? How to revive a dead church? The Jewish Talmud and its use for Christian apologetics, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making and based on 2 decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking.
It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken from the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org, equip.org. On this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, we're bringing you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Let's rejoin the conversation as Middle East and Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim speaks about the stark differences between the earlier and later teachings of the Quran.
Now, in this context, we got what's called the Medinan revelations. Now, these are remarkably different than the Meccan ones. Now, it's just basically a manual for how to raid and plunder, but surrounded in the garb of religious language. It's being done for God and God's sake or Allah and so forth. And this is where you have verses like Quran 9 and 9:29, which says, fight the people of the book, which is Islam's name for Christians and Jews specifically, until they pay jizya, that's the word used, which means tribute in exchange for their lives, so they buy their lives, and feel themselves humbled and subdued. And that actually is the cornerstone verse for the very concept of dhimma, or as we call it in English, dhimmitude, which whereby the Jews and Christians and those who are under Islamic authority, who are infidels, must feel humbled, must pay tribute, must be basically thankful they're even allowed to live and exist. And then what happened is when the Islamic jurists and the articulators of what's called Sharia, Islamic law, looked at the Quran to derive laws, they noticed this difference. You know, there is a contradiction in the Quran. So what they came up with is this, what in English we call abrogation, which means if there's a contradiction in the Quran, one verse says you have your religion, I have mine, and then all of a sudden another verse calls on Muslims to fight Christians and Jews, what do we do? And so they concluded that the newer verses always abrogate and cancel out the older verses. So the Meccan verses were applicable during that time only, and also applicable today when Muslims find themselves in a similar situation as Muhammad. So if Muslims are living in America, which is infidel majority, just like Muhammad was when he was living in Mecca and he was living under pagans and he was outnumbered, they should preach that Islam means peace. They should preach, you have your religion, I have mine. That is acceptable and expected. Once Muslims, however, are like Muhammad in his Medina period, stronger and able to do so, then they should go on the warpath and abrogate the former peaceful position that they had and that they voiced. So that is actually what I've just described is the mainstream understanding of how Islamic law is articulated and the current position of so-called infidels, specifically Christians and Jews, who must be fought against whenever possible until they are subdued and pay tribute.
Talk about a law, because this is kind of, it's certainly one of these things that is confusing to most people. First of all, people say that the Allah of Islam is the Allah of Christianity or the God of Christianity. But I suppose if you get down to brass tacks, Allah is the alter ego of Muhammad. Even Aisha, his child bride, said somewhere along the line, it seems like Allah is willing to give you whatever you want. In other words, it seems like every time you want to do something that might be untoward, all of a sudden a revelation comes down from Allah and sanctions it. The idea of Allah seems to me to be fictional and have nothing to do with divinity whatsoever. Because if it did, why would you need the abrogations that you talk about? And why are there such great distinctions between the Medinan Quran and the Meccan Quran?
Well, as to your first point, is Allah God? And this, again, is a byproduct of, you know, this sort of Western secular approach to religions, lumping them all together. You know, just like when they say, oh, look, Islam talks about Abraham and Muhammad and Jesus. Well, that's a good thing. Well, not really, because they've created different characters and said that the ones that exist in the Bible are false. So it's the same with Allah. If Allah is God, then he's schizophrenic, because the God of the Bible says things that counter 100% what Allah says in the Quran. So in my mind, these are different deities. That's absolutely for sure, because otherwise it's a schizophrenic God we're talking about. As to your point about Aisha, yes, that's a very well-known anecdote. And in fact, lots of Muslims who have apostatized, former Muslims, point to it. And to give listeners more detail, there's some story that happens, and essentially women started giving themselves up to Muhammad for sexual relations. And so Muhammad came up with a verse. He said, Allah has revealed to me a new verse. And this verse is in the Quran. And it basically says that the strictures placed on the average Muslim male, whereby he only has four wives, do not apply to Muhammad. He can have more wives and he can and do this sort of thing. And that's when his young child bride, Aisha, said exactly what you said. And she just kind of quips and said, it's interesting how your God always kind of, validates your fancies with revelations. And so many Muslims point to that. And furthermore, it's, you know, most people don't know this, but if you look at the early literature, the history of the earliest Christians, especially the Byzantines or of the Eastern Roman Empire, and the Syriacs and the Copts who lived under Islamic rule in the 7th and 8th centuries, when they finally got the Quran and the biography of Muhammad, they were scandalized at what they came across. And they said exactly what you're saying, which is, what sort of a God is this that exists basically to validate this man's most primordial and savage impulses for rapine and for rape and women and for plunder and for warfare? And they always highlighted especially the sexual discrepancies. For example, there's in the Quran, and this is probably the most remarked on or criticized by Christian theologians throughout the centuries, beginning in the 7th centuries. In the Quran, there's a story where the context is given in the hadith, but basically Muhammad saw his adopted sons. He went into his adopted son's tent and saw his wife, Zainab, I believe, uncovered. And so he became very attracted to her. And then when his adopted son found out about this, he felt bad and he essentially divorced his wife to give her up to Muhammad, and Muhammad married her. And so in the Quran, there's a verse which explains all this, and it says, it's very similar to the other one, which, you know, Muhammad is above and beyond reproach. What Muslim men can do, Muhammad can do more. He's not limited to anything, et cetera, et cetera. And in the context of this, in fact, Islam came to outlaw adoption because part of the rationale was, well, he was never his real son and you shouldn't be adopting and so forth. And it gets very convoluted. Anyway, this is what Christian theologians, as well as Muslims who apostatized, have always looked at and were scandalized at and said, is it not obvious to you people what a fraud this is? And from there, we can understand why it is that Islam is a religion of violence and force, why it has to impose its faith, and why it's the only religion that threatens those who leave it with death. Because if it didn't, it would not exist right now, because everyone would have left it by now.
You know, this must drive you crazy, Raymond. As a Coptic Christian, you would use the word Allah. And the meaning that you pour into that word is completely different than the meaning that a Muslim would pour into the word. So help people understand that it's the same word, but the meaning poured into the word by a Coptic Christian or a Christian in the Middle East would be very, very different from the meaning poured into that word by a Muslim.
Sure. Well, you know, historically, the Copts and all the other, you know, the Syriacs and the Assyrians and all these Christian communities who dominated the Middle East before the advent and conquest of Islam had their own language and had their own word for God. But increasingly, their languages, the Coptic language, for example, I believe it's around the 14th or 15th century under the Mamluks, was outlawed on pain of getting your tongue cut off. And you had to speak Arabic. And so in the context of speaking only Arabic, and of course in the context of as a dhimmi who doesn't want to draw any attention to yourselves, Arab-speaking Christians just adopted the word Allah. So it was, you know, advantageous for them to say, yes, I believe in Allah like you do. And it's even funny when you see the debates. Oftentimes Christians are very happy to say the first part of the Shahada, the Islamic creed, which is there is no God but Allah. But they hesitate and they try to dissemble and get away from the second part, which is, and Muhammad is his prophet. Because once you say that, of course, then you have to accept the Quran and the Hadith and so forth. So it was a sort of, you know, diplomatic maneuvering for them to simply exist and try to lessen their persecution. But absolutely, when any Middle Eastern Christian or Arab-speaking Christian says Allah, and they do, the Arabic Bible uses the word Allah and so forth, the God they have in mind is the Christian God, the God that English-speaker peoples call God with a capital G. And again, you know, based on the way that God is portrayed in the scriptures of Christians, is so fundamentally different than the way the God, Allah, of Islam is portrayed. These are different characters. And for us to say they're the same, then we have to accept that it's a schizophrenic God we're dealing with.
You know, you mentioned that word jizya earlier on, and for a lot of people, that's sort of a foreign word. Don't really know what you're talking about, but I suppose we could say, in common parlance, it's sort of like a gangster racket. And the reason I bring this up is it seems to me that a lot of people become Muslims because it's convenient. They don't want to pay the jizya. They don't want to pay the poll tax. They want to just forgo that. They're sort of secular in their leanings anyway, and no harm, no foul. I'll just become a Muslim, and it's a whole lot less expensive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, historically, the only very committed Christians and Jews and other people of whatever other faiths under Islam remained in that religion. When they did so, they knew that they are suffering social disadvantages. They're being essentially, they had to pay extortion money, which is this jizya, and so forth. And so anybody, you know, in as much as how much faith you had in Christianity, or how much you want to just get along and improve your lots in society, you would convert to Islam. Once you convert to Islam, then the jizya tax is abolished. You are now superior to any infidel around you. This is why today we see in Pakistan and Egypt, for example, any Muslim can go and just accuse this Christian of blaspheming Muhammad, and all of a sudden that Christian is thrown in jail, possibly killed, burned alive, and so forth. And everyone knows that more often than not, when Muslims do this, it's just for a personal vendetta. But they know they have this sort of social privilege, and they use it, and they exploit it, and Islam gives it to them. Islam says in a court of law, an infidel's word is half the value of a Muslim. So if it's my word against yours, I'm a Muslim, you're not, then your case closed, I win. So obviously, lots of people, and aside from that, you know, I've always seen, you know, a lot of people think, especially the context or the idea of jihad, that those who do jihad and those who attack and kill and rape and plunder infidels are essentially religious fanatics who believe they're going to die and go to heaven. I actually believe that there's a small core that fits that description. The overwhelming majority, and I've seen this from my studies in history and I see it now, did it because jihad is simply a very useful mechanism to allow them, to justify them to kill, rob, and murder the other. The religious minority in society. So it's not that. So again, if you look at Pakistan or Egypt or these countries that have Christians, and you will find often Christian girls are abducted and raped, Christians are robbed and plundered. Now the people, the Muslims who do this are not necessarily religious. However, they are banking on the fact that their religion makes a clear distinction between Muslims and infidels. And in fact, Islamic law teaches never can a Muslim side with an infidel against a fellow Muslim. And for that very reason, religious minorities have been and continue to be attacked because the people who attack them, not necessarily religious, but they know the authorities are not going to pursue them, because if they do, then they can play the Islamic card, accuse them of being apostates or siding with infidels, look, I'm a good Muslim, etc., etc. So Islam, in fact, does come with a lot of benefits, you know, very sordid and artificial benefits for those who join it against those who resist it and maintain their religious identity.
We'll pick up Hank's conversation with Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim in just a few moments. The Bible Answer Man broadcast and CRI's growing array of outreaches have never been more needed than they are today. And that's why we won't be shy in asking you to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Christian Research Institute through your persistent prayers and generous financial support. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and CRI in this battle for life and truth, and receive your copy of Muslim, what you need to know about the world's fastest growing religion as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. We'll be back after the break with more of the Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Raymond Ibrahim on this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making and based on 2 decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken? From the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Recent scholarly research has been significantly more open toward Jesus' healing the sick, his empty tomb, and even his post-resurrection appearances. So why have these same critics not fallen to their knees and proclaimed, "My Lord and my God"? Other topics include the Jewish Talmud and its use for Christian apologetics, the Cohen brothers and the riddle of existence, defending the biblical view of human sexuality using an effective Socratic question approach, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org. Are you the product of millions of years of unguided, purposeless natural processes? Or are you created in the image of a loving God? Faced with the overwhelming scorn of evolutionary proselytizers, it can be hard to articulate the truth about God's creative work. And even among faithful Christians, many misconceptions linger. The Creation Answer book by Hank Hanegraaff puts answers to the most hotly debated origins questions right at your fingertips, giving you clarity and understanding. Learn to articulate the truth about our origins clearly and compassionately when you request your copy of the Creation Answer book or listen to Hank's insightful answers with the unabridged audiobook version on CD. Receive your copy of the Creation Answer book or the audiobook on CD from the Christian Research Institute when you call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're bringing to you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast in which Hank spoke with Middle East and Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim. Let's rejoin the conversation.
Islam has for 14 centuries advanced by the sword. And the moment you make that kind of comment in polite company, people are immediately going to say, well, yeah, but that's what Christianity does as well. It doesn't just advance by the word, it also advances by the sword. I mean, think, for example, about the Crusades or these kinds of things, and you immediately see that there's a bloody edge to Christianity as well. How do you clarify that canard?
Well, Hank, I'm clarifying it right now by writing this book, The Sword and Scimitar, because this book is exactly written in my mind as an antidote to just what you said. I'm basically laying out the history of the conflict between Islam and Christianity. I'm showing that first it starts off with Islamic attacks on the Eastern Roman Byzantine Empire, which was the closest to it. And then essentially in one century, Islam had overrun, conquered all of North Africa from Egypt in the east to Spain, had entered into Spain and conquered Spain, and was now in France attacking. Now, some people may know that very generically. They just know, Islam and the Arabs rapidly spread in a century. They don't know how it was done. They don't read the details. All of that is in all these old, musty books, many of them not even translated, intentionally so. And this is what I've essentially marshaled and put into place to show you that, no, actually what they did is what ISIS did. They went into these places, they burned churches, they broke crosses, they raped nuns, they put the sword to them, they said, you convert or you die. Then they extorted them for money until there's anecdotes of Christians in Egypt that were reduced to starvation and basically gave their children away rather than be killed and have their children killed and so forth. In North Africa, there's anecdotes right there in the early first few decades of the Arab conquest of literally hundreds of thousands of slaves being herded across North Africa and taken to the harems of the caliph in Medina and so forth. And so, I spent three chapters documenting all that. And if anything, all that time, there's two successes, which was the famous Battle of Tours or Poitiers in 732, which essentially stopped the Arab advance, and that was in the west, and the lesser known but probably more important, Siege of Constantinople in 717, and essentially Constantinople prevailed, came out of it unscathed, and wasn't conquered. Now, if either of those two, one in the east and in the west, were conquered, it's very plausible to believe Islam, the whole history would have changed by now. There may not have been a Western world. There may not have been a Christendom. All of Europe could have been the northwestern appendage of the Islamic world. And then, finally, halfway through the book, we come to the Crusades. And again, I document because that is the fact. They were done in 100% as a response to these four centuries previous of nonstop conquest. And the most recent conquest or advance that the Muslims had done was the Battle of Manzikert in 1071, and that's why the Crusades come 1095, 24 years later. They had now overrun all of Asia Minor. They were essentially threatening Constantinople again, Jerusalem. All the pilgrims were being killed and raped. And so it was in that context, and the Pope and the Crusaders make it very clear that's why they're going to fight the Muslims, not because they're they're portrayed now as some sort of prototypical white colonizers going to disrupt the peaceful Middle East. I know that's the popular narrative by people like Karen Armstrong and so forth, and that's why I'm trying to set the record straight. So when you really look at the full history, you find out there's nothing to apologize for. There's absolutely no relationship between crusade and jihad, because one was an unprovoked offensive in the name of jihad, and one was 100% done in defensive measure. It's the same thing with the Reconquista, which few people know about. And if you read the literature, Spain was conquered. It was held for almost 800 years by Muslims. But from the very start, there was a small resistance up in the north in the mountains of Christians, of the indigenous Christians and the descendants of the Goths. And they continued fighting and fighting and advancing until 1492. When they took the whole of Spain back from Islam. Now, you read what they say, it's 100% just a defensive war, basically reclaiming our lost, stolen land. It's amazing to me, sometimes I watch documentaries about Islam in Spain, the wonders of Cordoba, and it will never occur to anyone who watches a show like that or even reads books that when Islam entered Spain, it was just a massacre. There's the rape of nuns and destruction of churches, forcing everything we're accustomed to, forcing them to convert, massacring them, taking tens and thousands into slavery. You won't get that. You'll just hear Islam was introduced in Spain in the 7th century. And then the next sentence is about all these architectural glories in Cordoba and supposedly some sort of culture of, convivacinia and Jews and Muslims and Christians getting along, all of which is absolute bunk. And a good book, if you're interested, is The Myth of Andalusia by Professor Dario Fernandez, which shows you all that, too, is nonsense. So, I'm glad you bring this up because I think the historical record needs to be straightened up and set aright. Because, like you said, whenever we talk about this, all of a sudden you're going to get in your face, well, what about the Crusades? What about this? And the only reason people say that is because they've been so misinformed, going back to your opening quote, by the intelligentsia and our own institutions, that they think now it's once again been made to be relative. Jihad is relative and the same thing as crusades, just like Allah and God are the same thing, just like the prophets of Islam in the Quran are the same as the one in the New Testament. No, they're so different. and people need to get the facts straight.
You know, you talk about the myth of the Andalusian paradise, and I think that bears some elaboration, because this is a myth that I have heard over and over again, and it's not by the average person. I mean, you're talking about people like Barack Obama pointing to this myth. You're talking about Carly Fiorina when she was running for president of the United States. You're talking about so many luminaries, educated Western people who repeat this myth over and over again, ad nauseum, ad infinitum. My question sometimes is this just a function of stakeholder interest? Is this a function of sloppy research? What's going on in terms of the people? These are smart people. How can they be so fooled by something that Snopes could uncover in a moment?
Well, you know, ultimately you have to lay blame at all these academics and prestigious scholars and prestigious universities who publish books saying all this stuff. And so it's harder for me to blame an Obama who maybe he read one of these books and he goes, okay, well, this is a well-known writer. It must be true. I really hold the academics accountable. But really, the deeper genesis of this sort of thinking, you know, I trace it sort of to the Enlightenment or so-called Enlightenment, which really had a very most people think it was an anti-Catholic sentiment, but I think it was an anti-Christian sentiment. And so everywhere, and you see this in the writings of Edward Gibbon, you know, he tries always, and others follow him, wherever you can find, you know, Muslims or non-Christians doing anything that could in any way be shown as at least neutral or even good, it is just blown out of proportion and juxtaposed as a way to sort of shame Christians and show how backwards they are, how whatever they are. And this is, you know, Voltaire and Gibbon, and this kind of thinking has gone on and on. It's only gotten worse by, you know, academics who just are convinced that historically Christianity was this retrograde, horrible, oppressive force. And in order to validate that, I think that's their first premise. I think that's their most the point they're most interested in making. And in order to validate it, what they do is they look for different civilizations and peoples and try to present them as, you know, so much more enlightened, so much more progressive, okay? And so that's what, so they came to the period of Spain, where Islam was in it, and there is, in Islam's 800 years of presence in Spain, there's about 30 years, and that's what they're talking about. There's 30 years where you had a couple of caliphs who, you know, the whole dhimma thing was still in order. If you're a Christian or Jew, you're paying jizya, you know, you're a second-class citizen. But there was a much opulence. There's the building of grand architecture. You had doctors and scientists working, most of whom were Christians or Jews or recently converted to Islam, Christians and Jews. And they've taken that, okay, and pulled it out, even though the larger history of Islam in Spain is constant carnage, war, and savagery, especially with the coming of two groups. One's the Almohads and the other is the Almoravidun, which were, you know, these groups that came from North Africa were basically Berbers, or as they were called, Moors, would make ISIS look like Boy Scouts. And they were fundamentally Islamic, and they came just killing Christians left and right. And they came on the behest and being called by the Andalusian Muslims once they saw that they were losing to the Christians. So basically, they found one little anecdote, which in and of itself, if it was something that Christians had done in history, would be absolutely nothing to warrant any kind of praise. But because it's Muslims, it's been taken and just augmented and exaggerated beyond reality. And then all these books are written, and every book builds atop the other book. And now you have basically, as we call it, it's a myth, the myth of Andalusia. It's not even real. If you look at the historical records as written by Christians and Muslims living in Spain, it was conflict that generally prevailed. And Muslims were there as occupiers because they had invaded it, just like they invaded Egypt and Anatolia and so forth. And yet, and when you bring this up, I'm glad you do, because it really shows you again how warped our idea and understanding of history is. And it's intentionally, going back to your first quote you opened, it's intentionally been crafted and fabricated in this way to create a false impression that never even existed.
You talk about some false impressions that are being created, and I don't think you and I have ever talked about this, but let me run this by you. I hear, whether it's Fox News or it's MSNBC or whatever it is, I always hear this moniker, radical Islam. At least now, more and more people are using the moniker, but it seems to me that what you're saying, Raymond, is that all of this is not radical Islam. It sounds more like run-of-the-mill Islam.
Yeah, it's mainstream Islam. You know, the adjective radical has been placed there to imply, you know, there's something weird or strange about it. And so, you know, we're given the dichotomy of moderate Muslim or just Muslim, which implies moderate, and then radical Islamist. Okay, I don't mind making a distinction between Muslims because, yes, there's, as we already mentioned, there's a lot of Muslims who are just Muslims because they live in Muslim countries and they just want to make do. It's not even that they believe in the Quran or anything, okay? And those do tend to be moderate, okay? But for me, a true Muslim, if you look at that word, Muslim in Arabic, means it's connected to Islam. Islam in Arabic and Muslim, they're conjugates of one word. And Islam means submit. Muslim means one who has submitted, okay? So what is it they're submitting to? They're submitting to what's known as Sharia, basically all these laws that have been promulgated supposedly by Allah or more realistically by Muhammad and, you know, by the schools of law and so forth. So if you get a Muslim, so-called, who, let's say he drinks and is and doesn't fast and, you know, he's a cool guy that lives next door and you hang out with him and he goes to parties, well, he's not a Muslim because he's not following the laws of Allah, right? And he hangs out with Christians and Jews and he kind of likes them. Well, that's the Muslim we talk about. We say he's a great guy. But in fact, he doesn't even warrant to be called a Muslim because he is actually defying Allah's laws, including do not befriend the Christians and Jews, which is verbatim in the Quran. So for me, the radical is, I would call the so-called radical Muslim a Muslim. Or a Muslim, and I would call what we call a moderate Muslim, I would call them cultural or nominal Muslims. People are just born into it. You know, they celebrate Ramadan. They don't even go to mosque. They don't pray or what, you know, do five prayers and so forth.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. To listen to this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. If you'd like to stand shoulder to shoulder with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute in the battle for life and truth, and receives our thanks for your gift, Hank Hanegraaff's book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion, or any of the other resources mentioned on the broadcast today, call our resource consultants now at 888-7000-CRI. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to us at CRI P.O. Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. The Coen brothers are among the most critically acclaimed film directors of our time, yet the meaning behind their movies is often veiled in mystery. This offers a clue about the Coens' worldview. The difficulty is part of the design. Other topics include changing attitudes toward the resurrection of Jesus. Is a pro-life hermeneutic possible? How to revive a dead church? The Jewish Talmud and its use for Christian apologetics, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making and based on 2 decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken? From the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Equip.org.